I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to our What Clinicians Want to Know series, and today's issue focusing on the diagnosis and management of ovarian cancer. Our particular target audience today is primary care physicians, general gynecologists, nurses, nurse practitioners, physicians assistants. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Michael Bierer, a medical oncologist from the University of Arkansas, and Dr. Katie Moore and Dr. Dave O'Malley, gynecologic oncologist. Katie's with the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center, and Dave is with the Ohio State University and the James Cancer Center. To kind of lay the background for what we're going to do today, because it's going to be a little bit different, I actually met with six people and interviewed them and edited their interviews and just pulled out very short sound bites from each one of them, reflecting different aspects of the topic we're going to talk about today. I met with three oncology nurse practitioners, Ms. Paula Anastasia, Ms. Courtney Arne, who actually works with Dave, Ms. Jacqueline Shaver, who works with Katie, and they talked a little bit about how they see patients coming to them as they're being diagnosed with ovarian cancer, various interesting insights. In addition, I met with two primary care docs, Dr. Sarin Kumar Shah and Dr. Tarek Chokshi. Both of these docs just had a couple of patients with ovarian cancer in their practices, but it turns out very interesting. And I also met with a general gynecologist, Dr. Wanda Tours. We'll hear from her later. And amazingly, that same morning, it turns out, Dr. Torres had actually met with a longtime patient and for the first time informed her that imaging had demonstrated a big ovarian mass suspicious for ovarian cancer. So it was kind of interesting timing there, having just gone through that experience. And if you really think about it, that's really more than anything, not just the diagnosis, that's the one moment that I think primary care docs, gynecologists have such an important impact. And Katie, I guess one of the things, it was interesting, and I can totally understand how it's so hard to keep up with things. Here's a situation that doesn't occur very much in general practice. And yet we've learned in oncology that there's certain situations that even though they're not common, you really need to be made aware of. And as I describe what's happened the last couple of years to these docs, their eyes got wide open in terms of the developments there. And I think makes a real big difference as you send a patient to a gynecologic oncologist or medical oncologist for them to go in with the idea that, hey, it's not like it was a few years ago. Before we kind of get into that, Katie, maybe you can just provide a little bit of perspective. A lot of people say that the last 2 years have been maybe the most important years in the history of treatment of ovarian cancer. Any thoughts?
I definitely agree with that. We probably since the development of platinum, and that's been several decades, we've made tremendous strides, really with the introduction of anti-angiogenic agents and PARP inhibitors into the treatment paradigm for women with ovarian cancer. And I'm really excited about this presentation today. It's so timely because if you look at just the social media or whatever online today, there's a story about a 49-year-old, very famous pool player. She's a Korean, was a professional pool player for many, many years. She's 49, has been diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer. And so, of course, I looked at it. And the story was she's been diagnosed, she's 49, and her doctors have given her months to live. And I was like, no, like, who is she talking to? Because that's not what we, in very rare exception, that's not the message, even in stage 4, that we give to women with epithelial ovarian cancer, to the point that I actually sent a message to this person. I was like, who are you seeing? Because if that's what we've been told, that's not true. That's not true. And so I think sending patients out with this, you have a bad deal, you have a cancer, we think you do, there's a lot that can be done. I'm going to get you to an expert. That's the key thing.
And, you know, Dave, one thing we found in doing research for this, I was shocked by the lack of coverage of this topic in primary care journals. I didn't even see a major article in the New England Journal, you know, with all the great artwork and everything. But if you look in the primary American, the family medicine journals, even the GYN journals, we did not really see the kind of, you know, the kind of cut to the chase. You know, it's fine to go through all the details, But docs in practice want to know the bottom line. That's what we're going to talk about today. It looks like it hasn't really been put out there that much. Maybe there wasn't that much to say, Dave. Any thoughts?
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head, Neil, which is these programs, these educational opportunities are the avenue in today's world to move forward. And we need to have people think about ovarian cancer when the patient comes in with vague abdominal or pelvic symptoms that are persisting and getting worse with time. And so when we look at that, hopefully through today, we can get that message out. And to reiterate what Katie said, you know, 10 years ago, we talked about 2 to 3 years survival in ovarian cancer. We're talking about curing a subset of patients 50% of the time, possibly. That may be overstated, but we're going to get into that some today.
So, Mike, you know, I guess the other issue is, you know, so much has happened in the last couple of years. You wonder what's going to be happening in the next few years because there's so many trials going on right now, new concepts, things that haven't been really employed. I guess one thing in particular, of course, everybody's so interested and excited about immune therapy. But the question, even though it hasn't really worked out very well up to this point with ovarian cancer, for example, the way it has in melanoma, lung cancer, et cetera, bladder cancer, now there are a lot of clinical trials going on, not just looking at immunotherapy, but all kinds of new strategies. Any comments on the pace of clinical research right now, Mike?
Oh, yeah. Well, again, you hit the nail on the head, Neil. You know, I have a historic perspective here because of my somewhat of this age. I trained in the 80s when platinum sort of burst through. But we had almost 15 to 20 years where we were offering platinum and Taxol and nothing else. And just in the last 5 years, through work by Katie and David and others, and our understanding of the molecular biology of this tumor, it's taken off. And it's actually hard to keep up with the number of trials that are ongoing and when they will finish. So we've got lots of really interesting combinations. I haven't quite given up on IO in the sense that I think we got into IO and ovarian cancer before we really understood a lot of the immunology about ovarian cancer. So as we get a better understanding of that, I think there'll be better and smarter, rational combinations of IOs. And so I keep my fingers crossed. I think we're going to get a bang for our buck out of that. It's just going to take a little bit longer.
So here's where we're heading. Basically, we're going to make rounds on these six people. I interviewed each one of them. I pulled out about a minute of video from each one. I'll tell you a little more about some of the things that we're just going to walk down the hall, stop in and see each person and hear a little bit from them and get their reaction. And we're going to start out with Ms. Arne, who had some interesting thoughts. You know, you think about the gynecologic oncology office, they're seeing these patients as they come in being diagnosed. So they know what happened in the 6 months and year before. Anyhow, here's Ms. Arne talking about what she sees in these patients.
Ovarian cancer is very challenging to diagnose because a lot of patients have vague symptoms, and they're symptoms that a lot of women in their 50s, you know, experience. So they might have some abdominal bloating, which they just attribute to weight gain because they may not be exercising as much as they had been before, or they have poor eating habits. So some women just think that they're gaining weight in that area and don't think that there's anything serious going on. They also can sometimes have changes in their appetite, but it can be subtle to the point where they don't reach for medical attention. And so when they do finally present to their GYN or primary care doctor, their symptoms have either advanced to the point where they do have such advanced disease, they're becoming more symptomatic, or by the time their primary care or GYN works them up appropriately and finds out that they do have ovarian cancer, it's usually more advanced. They're scared, you know, they're referred to an oncologist and they've just been told they have cancer. And it's hard because they're being told they have cancer by providers who don't specialize in oncology. So they're not able to answer all their questions or lead them in the right direction sometimes. So sometimes when they come to us, they have a complete misunderstanding of their diagnosis, what their treatment will look like, or even what their prognosis is.
So, Katie, I'm curious about your thoughts. So you see so many people with ovarian cancer, again, who've come through this path, sometimes very delayed. In the past, you know, we were hoping to get into a situation where the vast majority of patients with ovarian cancer, their initial surgery was to be done by a gynecologic oncologist as opposed to a general oncologist. Just kind of curious, Katie, on your perspective, these patients coming in, what are some of the roadblocks they encounter as they find their way towards you?
Well, I'm in a kind of a unique state in Oklahoma. We cover a lot of rural, 60% of our, actually, yeah, about 60% of our population is outside of urban areas. And you know, these are, you know, I take care of the best people. Sorry to the rest of you, but they're very salt of the earth. And so it's interesting. I have a new partner who came from Dallas, and I think of Dallas and Oklahoma, they're so close, it's kind of similar demographics, but she was there for a decade and says she's never seen patients come in as sick and as advanced as they do here. And so we really do, you know, we see patients who present with very advanced ovarian cancer. Like, we're not getting any stage ones or stage threes, you know, very advanced, very ill at presentation. And I think that the roadblocks are multifactorial, some of it's being rural, access to consistent care. You know, there's a lack of primary care providers in lots of rural America. So you kind of see people go into urgent care centers and not getting continuity of care. And that leads to delayed diagnosis or misinterpretation of symptoms. So you're sort of batted around to GI specialists and end up getting your gallbladder out to find your ovary cancer. We see that as well. So I think in my part of the world, it's a kind of an amalgam of challenges that range from sort of socioeconomic factors, geographic factors, and then I think access to consistent medical care.
Mike, you know, another issue obviously that's out there that affects everybody and everybody in medicine, including the patients, is COVID. And, you know, you hear more about patients coming in delay. They don't want to go to the hospital. They don't want to go to the ER. Any thoughts, Mike, about how this past year, have you seen any difference in how people present? And as you follow people, how, you know, COVID issues are sort of coming into the play?
Yeah, it's a really good. And to say that it hasn't had an impact, I think we'd be fudging it a little bit, because it definitely has had an impact. I don't think the health systems, at least our health system, hasn't denied care to somebody who has a suspicious mass, because that's a serious diagnosis. But I think the flip side, and it gets a little bit back into what Katie was talking about, my experience in Arkansas is that the people are really very much the salt of the earth, and in some ways don't really want to access the health system. They don't want to bother people with their problems. They're very tough people. You layer onto that COVID, and then I think that some of them don't seek help as early as they might have beforehand. Now, have we seen a stage shift? Not really, because most ovarian cancers, as mentioned before, present as advanced stage disease. But I don't think COVID-19 has helped us. And I would add one other factor based on what Katie said. I've seen the whole spectrum of care. When I was up at Boston and Mass General, that's a little bit more like what David has probably experienced, in the sense that it's a tertiary referral center. Patients there would come in with about 3,000 pages of Google printouts, pretty much telling me what they actually should get. That's very different in Arkansas. It's very much, I think, similar to what Katie said about Oklahoma.
So, Dave, I'm curious about your thoughts on this, and also this issue I brought up before about the issue of trying to minimize the number of people who get operated on by general gynecologists. Any sense for sort of how often that is happening and ways to try to sort of avoid that, and what, you know, what the potential consequences are for somebody not getting to operate on by a gynecologic oncologist?
Well, when we look at these patients, they really have, if they have ovarian cancer and they're operated on a GYN oncologist, the proper surgery, and then treated at a high volume center, the actually we see years improvement in survival. Rob Bristol looked at this data, literally 2 years survival if they get into the right people. Now, when we look at these and making decisions, my generalist GYN colleagues do an amazing job. And you know, 1 out of 100 women they see have a lifetime risk of ovarian cancer. So they're not seeing it that often, but have it in their mind. And then if you have a patient with a suspicious mass, making sure that you're doing the right thing with regards to referral for those with suspicious, Or if you're going to remove that mass, make sure it's removed intact. If it's with a minimally invasive option, put it in a bag. Don't rupture it so it spills. Put it in the bag, suck the fluid out, and pull that out. There's some really significant things you can do to minimize stage migration and improve outcomes in these patients. But the majority of the women still in the United States are treated by people who do not have specialty care in GYN cancers. And Mike is not a GYN oncologist, he's a medical oncologist, but he's been done specialized care and committed his career to the treatment of women with GYN cancers. So it's very important to get into those centers and at least partner if you have trouble. And Katie and I see the same thing in Columbus with Southern Ohio and throughout the into West Virginia. If you have trouble getting access into all your care in those centers, at least make sure you're consulting with the specialist.
So, and, you know, another issue, incidentally, is not everybody goes right to surgery. Now you have neoadjuvant pre-op systemic treatment that's used commonly in ovarian cancer. We'll get into that in a second. So the next person I want you to meet is Jacqueline Shaver, who's Katie works with in Katie's group. And she had some interesting comments. You know, oncology nowadays has become much more what they call personalized. And in particular, we're looking at the tumor. We're looking at the genomic profiles. We're looking at germline alterations to tailor the treatment to become personalized. And one area that this has become really important has been ovarian cancer. Here's Jacqueline commenting on it.
Especially in the primary care setting, getting that family history, cancer history, ovarian cancer history in the primary, like mother, grandmother, even a male with breast cancer, those can all signal some BRCA mutations. So getting that family history and even sending to a genetic counselor if needed to determine, you know, what genetic testing is appropriate for them. They may need even more extensive paneling than just the BRCA one. A BRCA 2. I had one this week who had a BRCA 1 mutation. Her grandmother was BRCA 1. She got a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy along with a hysterectomy with BSO. And so she came in wanting to know what type of surveillance that were needed after the fact of her getting those prophylactic surgeries. So hopefully she will have prevented a primary ovarian or a fallopian tube cancer. Now, there is still a risk of having another cancer called a primary peritoneal cancer that would be important also for the primary care to know. Even though we have removed the ovaries and fallopian tube, there is still a risk of primary peritoneal cancer with someone who has a BRCA1, BRCA2 mutation.
So, Mike, I guess, you know, if you stop and think about it, potentially, this is a curable or preventable disease. And actually, we're going to see a patient later who theoretically might have had this prevented and didn't, unfortunately. But let's just chat a little bit. We're not going to try to get into all the slides. You can look at the slides. We're posting them if you want to check them out. We're going to show a bunch of them. But I really just want to make rounds and just try to explain things face to face. And Mike, can you kind of begin the conversation of sort of the biology of ovarian cancer and why it is we're using these drugs like PARP inhibitors to treat, and in fact, in many situations, extremely effective. So can you talk a little bit about sort of the biology of ovarian cancer, particularly from the point of view of these mutations?
Sure, sure. I think there are a couple of major, shall we say, epiphanies that have occurred over the last 5 to 10 years, which has changed our understanding of the biology. And that has then led to a more effective way to treat this tumor. The first one is a recognition, it's a little confusing, but the recognition that ovarian cancer is probably not ovarian cancer, that a lot of the serous tumors, which is 70% of the cancers, high-grade serous tumors, actually come from the fallopian tube. And they come from the distal end of the fallopian tube. And that's probably why they spread fairly rapidly, because that tube is sort of, you know, waving there, and those cells can be shed rather early throughout the abdominal cavity. The molecular events that occur to generate that tumor, one is a tumor suppressor gene called P53 is mutated very early. We can't target that. But it's important to know the P3 basically maintains the genomic stability of cells. And then in combination with that, there are abnormalities which occur early, including BRCA1, BRCA2, BRCA1, BRCA2, and a whole host of other genes that involve what's called the Fanconi DNA repair pathway. So think about it. You've got a tumor that has the P53 gene knocked out, so it can't control its genome. And then you get this whole other pathway that is important in DNA repair. So this is a tumor that is, we call it a product of genomic chaos. It is it's changing continuously because it can't repair its DNA. And that is, in fact, why platinum works, because when we treat tumors with platinum, we produce more mutations. And there are so many mutations, even the tumor dies. That's why platinum works. And that is exactly why, in addition, the whole family of PARP inhibitors work, because PARPs are involved in that DNA repair pathway. And when that is already abnormal and you inhibit PARP, you create something called synthetic lethality, which is just a fancy name to say that the tumor dies in the presence of a PARP inhibitor. So it's a fascinating story. We've come a long way. And I think we're actually just on the beginning of this ride. We're going to find other targets. We're going to find other combinations with PARP inhibitors. And, I would point to this study that Katie did, Solo One, is, you know, we look at that, those survival curves and say, you know, for the first time, maybe we're looking at curing some patients with advanced stage ovarian cancer.
Yeah, when I was describing the results of Solo One to Dr. Torres, her eyes just got wide. You know, I could tell that, you know, it was like, of course, you know, the difference between having a median relapse, a chance of relapse of, you know, 13 months versus 5 years. And we'll get to that in a second. But just to continue this theme of trying to assess the sort of mutational profile in the patient, Dave, I guess one thing, you know, we've learned is that you get information not only by germline testing, but also somatic testing, looking at the cancer itself to see what the abnormalities are. Can you talk, actually, first, before you even get into that, Dave, just maybe you can comment on what Jacqueline was talking about with peritoneal cancer, what that is, how people present. I know it's very, very uncommon, but can you comment on what that is? And then dive a little bit into the type of mutation testing that's done in these patients.
So primary peritoneal cancer is probably from an embryologic origin. And with we develop and the ovarian epithelium is exposed to the entire peritoneal cavity. And so what we see is instead of the cancer starting the ovaries or the fallopian tubes, as Mike just said, it actually starts in the upper abdomen, most commonly in the omentum. And so we see the same distribution of disease we see in metastatic ovarian cancer, but with the majority of the disease being the upper abdomen. Now, when we're diagnosed with one of these patients, we found not only do we need to get the germline that you so eloquently stated, but we also can test the tumor. This genomic instability, these multiple mutations that Mike was talking about, occur beyond within the tumor, and we see the same changes of BRCA in the tumors. But what else do we have? We have this group of these collections of homologous recombination deficiency. And it's in the same class that we know when we test the tumor and we find that even though the genes are normal, there's BRCA abnormalities in the tumor, there's RAD51, C and D, I could list a bunch of them. Those patients respond in some mutations just as well in the germline BRCA. And then we have this another subgroup that may not have those mutations, but have the abnormalities in the tumor, which also shows that they have a better chance to respond to platinum, PARP inhibitors, or combination of PARP inhibitors.
So Katie, you know, we've also, I think Dave was alluding to this, have assays now for what's called, you know, homologous recombinant deficiency. Can you talk a little bit more about why that concept is so important to the use of PARP inhibitors and why, you know, kind of the more problems you see with DNA repair, the more likely they are to respond? And also whether you see these kinds of, you know, germline abnormalities in people with no family history.
Right. So those are meaty question. But it kind of comes back to what Dr. Beer was alluding to in his discussion, that BRCA is, of course, the most prevalent mutation that we see in ovarian cancer that's targetable, and that basically induces a vulnerability in that tumor cell to repairing its DNA. So you've taken, and I think you may have a slide for this later, you've taken already one of the legs off of a stool. So one leg is gone. And then you challenge that cell with platinum or a PARP inhibitor or any kind of drug that damages DNA, and you've already taken out its key ability to fix its DNA, you get this sort of cell death. You take out the other leg of the stool and the stool can't stand. But what we know is that there's BRCA, germline, there's somatic BRCA. So you're not born with a BRCA mutation, but your tumor has a deleterious BRCA mutation, and that responds just as well to PARP inhibitors and likely platinum as a germline, and it's not heritable, but it's important for us to find that out and find that out from a tumor test. But then there are other changes in the tumor. There's other gene mutations that are very rare, like 1 to 2%. So they're hard to test for individually, but we get them in amalgam, you know, in these panel tests. But there's also what we call epigenetic changes. So the genes are normal. The sequences are normal, but you kind of think about it like a wad of gum, like stuck on the beginning of the gene, and the gene just can't be turned into a protein because it's just got a wad of gum sticking there. Those are epigenetic changes. And so you could have a normal BRCA gene, but if I can't make a BRCA protein, it's just like I have a BRCA mutation. And those patients are going to respond to PARP. And so we can pick up most of that in these assays, and there's a few that are FDA approved. One is Myriad and one is Foundation. There are others in development that test for something called homologous recombination deficiency. Homologous recombination is the high fidelity way that cells fix double-strand DNA breaks. And so if you're deficient in that through any one of those myriad of reasons that I just said, you're more likely to respond to PARP. And so you're identifying, inclusive of BRCA, you're identifying women who are more likely to respond to PARP than if they are homologous recombination proficient by virtue of that assay. So it helps with counseling. The problem is that those tests, as of yet, they're good tests, but they're not perfect. And so you don't identify everybody who will benefit from a PARP. And so they don't tell you who should and shouldn't get a PARP. They just tell you gradations of expected response in terms of counseling. So they're useful for patient counseling.
So actually, it's, you know, amazing. It's like this topic is like the Talmud. We've done like so many webinars for oncologists on it, and they're never the same. We start presenting real patients, like every single one is different. But we're just trying to cut to the chase and get to the stuff that we think primary care people need to know about. So let's hear from another oncology nurse, Paula Anastasia. And she has a couple comments. And after this, I'd like Dave to react to what she says. Here's Paula.
If a patient presents with symptoms greater than 2 weeks or a mass, they'll do an ultrasound in the office. But there's a triage test called the OVA1. And if it's greater than 4, it's recommended that this patient should be referred to a gynonc and not the gynecologist doing the surgery, because it's more likely to be a malignancy. It's not an absolute, but it's part of the triage for the gynecology practice.
When you see these people coming in, what are some of the delays that occur?
Many people, if they don't have a gynecologist or seeing their primary care, who don't see ovarian cancer that often. And they're like, oh, it's just stress, or go to a GI doctor. And so they're not really focusing on the symptoms. It's kind of like ignored. And I think women sometimes ignore it too. They're too busy. And then we know this year or last year with COVID, it's kind of like, oh, I'm not going to go into the physician's office for something like this. I'm going to treat it with over the counter. But we do know that the patient knows when something's wrong, and it's when something is persistent. So it's not like comes and goes. It's something that this is going on every single day. And then obviously increased abdominal girth. And sometimes we just think, well, I'm getting older, adipose tissue in my tummy. That's just me. I'm not eating properly. So a lot of it is just kind of ignored because it's so subtle. And so it takes months and months.
So, Dave, you know, this is one paper that reviewed the topic. There are actually not that many out there. You have both the OVA1 and ROMA assays that are FDA approved in this situation. Any thoughts about this and whether, you know, there's always debate about, you know, this kind of situation. The idea is you're trying to get, as we talked about before, the patient to a gynecologic oncologist, but not unnecessarily. Any thoughts about these kinds of assays, Dave, as opposed to just, you know, looking at the image?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of old school. Not quite as old as Mike, but still old school, you know. When we have these, you have somebody, you thought about it, order the ultrasound, get the CA125, if they're postmenopausal. I mean, just brainless. They have those symptoms, order the ultrasound or the CA125. Now, if I can see the films and an experienced GYN doctor can see the films, they're going to know if it's more suspicious. Now, some of these objective, the ROMA and the OVA1, can help triage. And it's that patient's referring to earlier today. Is it the patient that you as the generalist are going to take to the operating room versus get them into a GYN oncologist? But again, if you're doing the ultrasound in the office, see those films, you see those solid areas, you see that nodularity, have a GYN oncologist do that surgery.
So we're going to move on now and hear about some actual cases from these people. But before we do, we're going to put out some questions to the audience. So audience, I want to know what your thoughts are. If you have a patient with stage 3 ovarian cancer, so disease still in the abdomen, the patient has a BRCA germline mutation, so you already know that, and they get surgery and chemotherapy. They might get the chemo first, they might get the surgery first. And that was really the treatment up until a couple years ago. And so the question is, about how long do you think it's going to be before the tumor comes back in either a metastatic or local situation? And, you know, really once that happens, people are not curable. So the audience is saying, Katie, 2 years. Some are saying 1 and 3. But before you comment on it, Katie, because you're the one who did the first presentation in 2018, I think it was October, at the European ESMO meeting, European Society of Medical Oncology. So we asked you that, and there was a trial that actually compared, that Katie did, that compared these two options, because the other treatment that half the patient or the other patients got in the trial was a PARP inhibitor, which we're going to talk about. So just kind of curious what you would estimate would and be, okay, you estimated median of 2 years, what it would be if you give the patient a PARP inhibitor. And it looks, Katie, like people are split between 5, 3, and 2. So I think there's a sense that it's better. But what actually, we'll actually look at this, Katie, but what first blush, where were we 3 years ago? And when you presented these data globally, what did you see?
Yeah, so when we presented SOLO-1, which just to remind the audience was the first study ever done, prospective study ever done for women with BRCA-associated ovarian cancer, enrolled from 2013 to 2014. So it actually was kind of an old study by our current standards. And we randomized them to get olaparib for 2 years or placebo after they responded to their chemo. And for the group of women who were randomized to placebo, the median progression-free survival was 13.1 months, which was quite surprising that it was that low. So it's about a year.
And then when you give the PARP inhibitor?
Yeah, when we presented the data in 18, we had 41 months of follow-up and the median progression-free survival could not yet be reached, it wasn't reached, like half the patients hadn't recurred yet by that point. And that's just almost still true. We just updated the data this in 20, so we now have 5 years of follow-up and it looks like our median is right about 56 months.
So almost 5 years. So you've gone from a little bit more than 1 year to 5 years. And of course, right now, we don't know what this is going to mean 5 or 10 years from now. Are these people cured? Is their survival greater? But clearly a gigantic difference in outcome. You know, so I was just flashing, Katie, I was interviewing a medical oncologist a couple hours ago from Tennessee. She presented a woman who presented 5 years ago, and she tried to get her on the SOLO-1 trial, and she wasn't eligible. And the patient, it was a teacher, and they were talking about it, and she said, well, how about just give me the drug, because it really sounds promising. And so she managed to get olaparib, and now it's 5 years later, and this patient's doing great. But I'm not necessarily recommending it, but kind of an interesting story. Yeah. So audience, I want to come back to you in terms of, I'm sure you've heard plenty of stories like that.
Yes.
I want to come back to you, including in your practice probably. But in any event, I want to come back to you, audience. I want to know what you know about PARP inhibitors in terms of tolerability. You've heard that the benefits there are very substantial. The question is, what's the downside? And actually, interesting, a lot of the audience is aware of the fact that you see both GI symptoms and cytopenias. Mike, can you kind of provide a little bit of an overview of what you see? These are oral agents, but what you see, and even just because something's PO doesn't mean it's not going to have tolerability issues. What you typically see with these patients in terms of side effects, Mike?
Sure. And I would start out with the caveat that they are well-tolerated drugs. They really are. I think when study 19 was just starting, one of the patients commented to Jonathan Letterman, who was running it, saying, this is not chemotherapy. So they are generally well-tolerated. There is a class effect for GI toxicities. There's some nausea. I've actually never seen a case of vomiting, but it is reported. What's important to know about the GI effects is that they tachyphylax, meaning that they disappear after about 4, 6, maybe 8 weeks. I do have colleagues who will preemptively use antiemetics. I don't do that. If someone's really nauseous, then I'll just treat them. So GI is one. Probably the most problematic toxicity, in my view, is fatigue. There is a fatigue associated with this. And the reason is, if you have active ladies, active women, even grade one fatigue or grade two over a long period of time could be really a problem. I usually put them on a trial of Ritalin, which helps about half of them. The other half actually feel worse, in which case then I will eventually dose reduce if I have to. And then the cytopenias are real. I don't think they're really very hard to deal with. I see a little bit more anemia with rucaparib. And I usually don't, I never use a costimulatory factor. I don't usually dose reduce unless they are transfusion dependent, which is rare. And then thrombocytopenia is actually, if you look at the phase one trials associated with all of the agents, but the one where it's the biggest problem is niraparib. If you look at the NOVA trial, there were some patients whose platelets went down to literally 4,000, 2,000. So the FDA basically said that when you put a patient on niraparib, you need to do weekly platelet counts for the first month, because that's when you see it. So I don't know if we'll go over it later on, but there are very clear dose reduction algorithms for all of these drugs. And again, I just emphasize a wonderful class of drugs because it's pretty easy to manage.
So, Dave, I have this, one of the things I'm curious about, I like to ask a lot of people whether you think these drugs cause insomnia and whether that contributes to fatigue, but also curious another issue that's been out on the table, Dave, and now that we're seeing these survival or disease-free survival benefits, is the question, we know these drugs can have an effect on the bone marrow, and the question is whether or not they're going to increase. We know chemotherapy in the long term can increase the risk of MDS or acute myeloid leukemia. So what do we know about that in PARP inhibitors, and any experience in terms of insomnia? And the other thing I was going to also bring out is Mike was mentioning about niraparib and dropping the platelets, but it seems like a lot of that has sort of been diminished by adjusting the initial dose based on the weight and the baseline platelet level. So insomnia, MDS, and niraparib and platelets, Dave.
That's a lot. Do I have the next 20 minutes?
45 seconds.
All right, 45 seconds. MDS. You know, the most interesting part of, I believe, in Katie's update was of the Solo 1 data is that the MDS was still about 1.5%. And that was of concern in the Cello 2 data, which we actually saw up to about 8% MDS. So when we limit the treatment to 2 years, like was limited in Cello 1, we maintain the previous rate of MDS. So these patients clearly have to be followed. The weights and plates in niraparib, if you have a patient less than 77 kilos and about 150 of their platelets, if their platelets are less than 150,000 when you start, you should start them at 200 milligrams. And that's the niraparib, again, higher hematologic toxicity, but once a day dosing. So when we look at that, we see a significant reduction in grade 3 thrombocytopenias. But it is still a little bit higher than the other two medications in the class, the rucaparib and olaparib. Now, the insomnia is really interesting. There's definitely an impact in the serotonin. And when we see this at times, but I can tell you overall, I haven't had a whole lot of problems with being able to overcome it with our usual sleep aids.
So let's get into some cases here and see how this is playing out. We asked these docs that if they had any cases of ovarian cancer, and even though they had very few, it was quite interesting to hear about it. So Dr. Chotsky has an 80-year-old woman and quite an interesting story with a lot of teaching points. Here's Dr. Chotsky.
I can count under my fingertips, but I do have a few patients that are ovarian cancer patients, and it has been somewhat challenging at times to manage them with various complexities and issues that goes around their management. We do take recertifications in exams, but it's very difficult for us to keep up. As you understand, medical oncology world changes so rapidly, but it does not trickle down to us what is relevant for us in the primary care setting. I have a patient currently who is 80 years old, who is BRCA2 positive. She has a daughter who has bilateral mastectomy because of the breast cancer, as well as hysterectomy. And her granddaughter, who is a senior in college, is also our office patient, actually. So we have three generations of women in our practice with the positive gene, actually.
Wow.
It is a very unique situation. The particular patient does not want any surgery, no radiation. That was very clear. And I have to say that currently this is free. And that is a next to miracle, actually, to us. I think when we started this drug, we had no idea what are we entering into it, actually. This was 2 years ago when we started, actually. She's a small, petite lady. So we thought that she's so cachectic. We thought that she's not going to make it. And it was 2018 and now it's 2021. It's a blessing that we can see this class of drug making a miracle.
Has she gained weight since the initial treatments were started?
So she regained her weight loss and now she's stable over a year.
And any side effects at this point from the medication?
Nothing that I just saw her recently in January.
So, Katie, you know, you forget these people. People are seeing their primary care docs, they're seeing their gynecologists as well. You know, this long period of time when they're getting maintenance therapy. This lady actually received chemotherapy, so she got carboplatin, a common regimen used, did very well with it. Then got put on olaparib, and you can hear what happened. She didn't even have surgery. Any thoughts about this case? I guess the one thing about it, Katie, I think is a very important teaching point, is the implications of a BRCA germline mutation to the rest of the family. Because this patient got chemotherapy and all this for a potentially preventable situation. It seems like, from what I can tell, when the daughter was diagnosed, they were focusing more on the younger people in the family, and they picked this up in this 22-year-old daughter of hers, but they didn't think about the mom, the grandmom, who was in her 70s. So any thoughts about this case and how amazingly well this patient's done, Katie?
Yeah, I think, I'm so pleased to hear. It always makes us happy. And I, you know, everyone here, we all teach residents and fellows. I always try to bring my fellows in to meet these women because they're in the hospital so much and they see patients who are ill. And then you kind of walk in and see someone who's 5 years out, no evidence of disease, living their life. It sort of gives them it helps us, I think, as much as it helps our patients sometimes. So BRCA certainly does have a positive prognostic prediction, I guess, for outcomes. even with platinum therapy alone. BRCA2, now that we're actually collecting this data in every study up front, we're actually understanding it prospectively much better. In the past, it was all sort of epidemiologic data. And we're getting enough sort of differentiation between BRCA1 and 2 that we'll probably be able to make some statements about the differences as well. They both do well. BRCA2 does really well with chemo alone, although we don't know that from the past, but definitely with chemo and PARP, they can do really, really well. But they're a much smaller kind of subset of the BRCA population. It does, you know, I think I can't overestimate the importance of genetic counseling. I put that in my comment. And I also can't overestimate the fact that we don't have enough of them because we're all human and we make mistakes when we're trying to cover three professions in our one profession. And so this is really a case where a genetic counselor would have been like, everyone needs to be offered testing, men and women. That's very common. Like the sons and brothers are like, I don't need to be tested, but they absolutely need to be tested and they need to understand the implications of that testing. It's a lot of discussion. But we create previvors, you know, I don't want to treat women with ovarian cancer anymore. I want to prevent it. Retire.
So, yeah, when you talk about genetic counseling too, I think, you know, the wave of telemedicine that's taken over medicine in the last year, I think that one of the few positive sides of COVID, but in terms of genetic counseling, to me, that's going to really make a huge difference. Quick question for the Yali in the chat room brought up, Dave, interesting, is the issue of patients with these BRCA germline mutations. What do you do about their breasts? You know, in general, when you think about this, certainly you don't want to do a bilateral mastectomy on a patient who has 6 months to live. But as we're seeing, that's not at all the case here anymore. But you also have the option of a close screening. How does that play out in your practice, Dave? And if you are going to do a mastectomy, like when do you try to time it with the ovarian cancer treatment?
Well, when you have a patient who's diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer, again, we want to kind of get them up and through therapy and make a discussion. You know, this data from SOLO-1 that Katie is you know, presented to the world is really going to make us rethink all of these options. In the past, if somebody's diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer, I probably would not have referred them for mastectomy. But now, today, this is a discussion we have to have. But the problem is we haven't yet, the breast surgeons haven't caught up with our data. So we have to educate them that these patients have a very good chance to be alive 5, 10, maybe be cured of their disease. My answer in the chat was really the patient who had not yet been diagnosed with ovarian cancer, who's diagnosed with BRCA. Very important to get in, see somebody who knows what to look at, what there's potentially preventative measures that we can do for these patients, not just mastectomy. In addition, the technology with regards to reconstruction and the options for patients, if they're interested in that, has really increased over the last 5 years with nipple sparing and some of the options available for mastectomy. But again, trying to get into people who have an interest, breast surgeons who have an interest in genetic predisposition, is very important in the overall decisions of the person.
Yep.
So I want to sort of breeze through a bunch of slides. We'll do a few slides in this program. I really just wanted to talk and make rounds with the three of you, but let's show some of them. Before we do, you know, one of the main reasons is to have the primary care people prepared to deal with the situation that they only encounter occasionally, but the patient with who's very suspicious. And as I mentioned, I was very surprised, which is one of those coincidences that seem to follow us around when we talk to Dr. Torres. And here is Dr. Torres talking about really her day, what happened that morning to her.
I've been in practice now for 20 years, and so I have a pretty mature practice. So I see the whole spectrum of OB and GYN. So I do the workup for ovarian cancer. So as a matter of fact, today I saw a 74-year-old that has been my patient for a while, and I had not seen her in 3 years. She was following up with her primary care. And she complained of some pelvic pain, and they did the workup at the primary care. So an ultrasound showed a 9.6 centimeter complex left ovarian mass, and they refer her back to me once I review the tumor markers, I will refer her to the GYN oncologist in our area.
So when you visited with her today, did she already know about this mass, or you told her about it today or when you saw her?
I told her about it today. She didn't know that she had the mass.
And what's her sort of life situation?
She is a widow and she is a smoker. She's retired at 74.
What was it like talking to her today about this?
So since we had some rapport, she was curious to see why, you know, the urgency of the appointment, because she didn't have a clue of what was going on. She just thought she had some stomach issue. And of course, I went over her results and I explained to her that in this age group, we definitely need to rule out for anything cancerous. So that was why it was so urgent. But she denied any change in bowel habits. She did not have any postmenopausal bleeding. Whenever you tell a patient that you have to rule out cancer, that of course causes anxiety. She was emotional, of course, and very concerned about the results.
So you can imagine this is probably the most momentous day in the life of this 74-year-old woman, a day she will never forget. And what one of our goals here today and just moving forward is to have patients better prepared to make that move from primary care to gynecologic oncology offices. And so I'm going to run through a few of the slides, you know, kind of basic stuff, but really maybe just to give more of a visual picture. So, Mike, we were talking about this. This is the kind of biology that I can understand, you know, the idea of knocking out these tables. Can you just elaborate a little bit more, Mike? Because I feel like the more I hear about it, the more I understand it, what we're really trying to do with these PARP inhibitors and what the meaning of this kind of a graphic is in that regard.
Sure. Yeah. And it would be really tragic if there was a glass of beer on that table. So the argument here, and I think Katie touched on this, is that, and I alluded to it in the sense that ovarian cancers have this defect in DNA repair. And that's because they've lost the BRCA1 gene or the BRCA2 gene or a bunch of other genes. And so they cannot repair what's called double-stranded breaks, which is that leg up there that says homologous recombination repair. Okay, so when you can't do that, you have the table on the right, top right, which is no HR repair. So you've lost one leg, but the table's still standing. Now you come along and you inhibit PARP, which inhibits a different type of DNA repair. You've lost two legs. The tumor now dies. So that's the concept. And frankly, in my lifetime, and as Dave would say, in a long lifetime, it's one of the best examples of what I call bench to bedside. This whole thing was worked out mostly in the UK, but the US and Canada contributed to it. It was all done in the lab, and then it was done in animals, and they basically developed PARP inhibitors based on this. And then it took a little while to get it into clinic, but it all just panned out beautifully, I think. It's just a wonderful, wonderful example. And it makes us all very excited that we're going to have another wave of these agents coming.
So, Katie, this is a study that you presented, as we were talking about, in the fall of 2018, a little bit over 2 years ago, the so-called SOLO-1 study. We'd seen studies previously with the three PARP inhibitors looking at in the recurrent setting, but this is the first one to report it as part of upfront therapy. Can you talk a little bit about the type of how the design of the trial, the kind of patients that went in, what the randomization was, and then we'll talk about the results?
Sure. So SOLO-1, as I mentioned previously, enrolled women with stage 3 and 4 epithelial ovarian cancer. They all had to have a BRCA mutation. The vast majority were germline. There were only 2 patients enrolled who had a somatic mutation. And they had to have a surgery either at the beginning or in the middle. And at the end of their chemotherapy, which could be whatever the provider wanted to use, they had to be in response. And at that point, they were randomized to placebo or olaparib until progression or 2 years. And what you're showing right now is the updated progression-free survival curves. And so how you interpret this is the maroon curve is the women that received olaparib, and the blue curve is the women who were randomized to placebo. And at that 24 months, you see in green, that's where the assigned therapy was discontinued. And so some of the important things to note here are, if you look at the far left of this curve in the blue line, about 20% of women, even with BRCA mutations, recur within 6 months of completing chemotherapy. So they are primary platinum resistant, which we know is a very poor prognostic marker. And you eliminate that with use of PARP, that shoulder is gone. And the second important thing is when we discontinue the PARP, if that green sign that you can see there, the curves don't come back together. So it's not like you're just treating something and keeping it at bay and then you withdraw it. You would expect to see the curves coming back together. The curves have remained relatively parallel since that time, which gives us a lot of hope that many of these women will not recur ever, we hope. But certainly at the 5-year mark, we are almost 50% of women without recurrence.
And if you look over on the right side, you see HR equals 0.33. That's that, quote, hazard rate. And basically, for those of you who are not in oncology, what that translates means is a 67% reduction in the risk of relapse at any given point in time in this curve. So, you know, for oncology, that's a pretty big number. And Dave, we also saw, and of course, this was then quickly approved, of course, and published. But then, Dave, we then saw another study looking at a different PARP inhibitor. As I mentioned, there are three, and niraparib is another one that had been used just for recurrent disease. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the PRIMA trial, because one big difference between this and the SOLO-1 trial, which just had patients with BRCA germline, kind of as a proof of principle, is this let in everybody, regardless of their genomic profile. So some of these people didn't have HRD, they didn't have BRCA mutations, and yet they still saw a benefit. Can you talk about this trial, Dave?
Yeah, so a high-risk population of patients, they needed to have disease at the end of their surgery, after the debulking surgery, or neoadjuvant, or stage 4. What we found here is that everybody benefited. And we look at these subpopulations. The greatest benefit was on the BRCA patient, but we continue to see benefit in the BRCA wild type HRD positive, which is up on the screen now. Again, more than doubling of the improvement in the progression-free survival. You see that hazard ratio up there, again, 60%. And then as we look at, the wild type is the next one, which is, again, more than doubling with a hazard ratio of 0.5. But even in the HRD negative BRCA wild type, those patients also benefited. And what this did was lead to the approval in all patients who respond to a platinum doublet with advanced ovarian cancer. It's important to note another important difference in this trial is that the patients were treated for 3 years rather than 2 years, like in SOLO-1.
So we're just trying to get out of, chapter one in this. Hopefully we'll be able to get into more detail in the future. We can also talk, as you can see here on this slide, about another strategy combining the anti-VEGF antibody bevacizumab with a PARP inhibitor, which has been shown to be effective and safe. We're not going to get into the details of who gets what, et cetera, but they also saw a benefit there. But I did want to finish out with one more case. This is from Dr. Shah. I'd like you to just listen to the case. It kind of gets into a couple other issues that I think are worth noting. I'll ask Katie to finish out with comments on this. Particularly, I was curious. He actually told me that there wasn't a gynecologic oncologist in their area. So if they were going to send it to, they'd have to send it to a tertiary center. But also, I thought it was interesting in terms of some of the communication issues that came up. Here's Dr. Shah.
I think she was in early 60s, and she was complaining of significant weight loss and some nonspecific abdominal pain. And we initially did the routine work of blood tests, and that initial blood work didn't show anything. Tried sometime a non-specific medicine, omeprazole, and then we did CT scan and ultrasound. And that's how they say there's a suspicious mass and some kind of cyst around ovaries was seen. And then I ordered CA-125 and other tests.
It sounds like you're the person who actually, for the first time, brought up the issue of ovarian cancer to her.
Right. And that's what I do.
I'm curious how she reacted.
Initially on very first visit, not very much because she doesn't speak very well English, but she speaks Gujarati and I speak Gujarati for her. And her daughter always comes with her. So it was a little bit easier when I said that, okay, I will need the opinion from a cancer specialist. I'm going to refer you to them. Let's see what they say, if she needs further testing, and we will get work with the expert people. So that is how I start with them. And then I bring her back in follow-up for 2 to 3 weeks or 4 weeks follow-up. I said, okay, tell me what cancer doctor told you and what they are going to do for you. So at least it gives me idea what patient understand.
So Katie, do you speak Gujarati? Just kidding.
I do not.
I just thought, sure, you know, when you listen to him, you realize, you know, these people still have their hypertension, they have their diabetes, they're seeing their primary care, they're seeing their gynecologist. And to have somebody on your team there, as he's talking about, to sort of advise them, learn about what's going on. Any thoughts about this sort of partnership, Katie?
I mean, I'm really impressed, to be honest. I think, and Dave and Mike have been on these, we have some ongoing, very recent committees looking at equity and cancer access, but also equity and clinical trial access. And language barriers are one of the things that we're increasingly very sensitive about. You know, still, this woman is likely excluded from any clinical trial for her cancer, even if it would benefit her, because we don't have Gujarati consent. You know, so I'm impressed that she has this provider who is so invested in her care and is providing that continuity. That's just not the case in many parts of the country where you have a consistent primary care provider. And so I think it really points out the importance of the primary care physician in the care continuity of care for women for all things. He's going to help manage her hypertension. He's going to help manage her diabetes if she has it, while the oncologist can hopefully take great care of her cancer. I mean, I'll tell you that I manage my patient's hypertension because they don't have a PCP. So I'm starting amlodipine. You know, I do that because someone has to do it, but I'm not a board certified internal medicine specialist. So I'm impressed by him. I think that is maybe not the model that all patients have access to. So that's just what I would say.
Well, that can be our goal. Hopefully this will just be chapter one. There's so much more to say in terms of ovarian cancer, but hopefully we were able to make some useful points to you.